Let's start today with a pop quiz. Here we go. In 1970, what percentage of 30-year-olds in America were earning more money than their parents had earned at that age, adjusted for inflation, of course? That is question number one. And question number two, what percentage of American 30-year-olds today earn more than their parents earned at age 30? I'll give you a second to think it over. All right, you ready for the answer? The percentage of American 30-year-olds in 1970 who were earning more than their parents had earned at 30 was 92%. Isn't that amazing? That, in a nutshell, is what we call the American dream. And what's the percentage now? It's somewhere around 50%, which has led some people to say this.
Sadly, the American dream is dead.
Donald Trump's view of the American dream and his promise to revive it had a lot to do with his getting elected president. According to Gallup polls, before the election, more than 50% of Americans saw our economic conditions worsening. And in case you're wondering, it's not just cranky old people. A poll from the Harvard Institute of Politics found that nearly 50% of millennials think the American dream is, quote, dead. We went out on the streets of New York ourselves to ask people if they thought the American dream was real and achievable.
Absolutely, it's real. I mean, especially standing here in Battery Park, you look at different people from all across nations that come to America to realize the American dream.
I think that if you really work hard, then you can do whatever you want in America. It might be a little difficult at first, but you can still do it.
I don't think the American dream is achievable. I think it's a motivator to try to achieve it.
The American dream is something of a mythology for a way in which to advance and have a good life under what is essentially not just a capitalist system, but a country founded on exploitation.
You put in some work, you put in some sweat, and you can definitely make the American dream happen.
While there's a lot of cynicism over the American dream, I am a product of it. My family, our families are refugees, came to this country about 30 years ago, had nothing, was able to send all their kids to college, was able to have a house, was able to give a better future for myself and their children than they would ever have had back in Vietnam.
A lot of the conversations we have these days about the American dream are in political terms or theoretical terms. But today on Freakonomics Radio, the actual unvarnished economics of the American dream, which we will define for the sake of today's conversation as this.
If you're born into a low-income family, do you really have a shot at rising up no matter what your background is?
And we'll discuss whether the American dream is really dead or maybe if it's just moved a bit north.
You're twice as likely to realize the American dream if you're growing up in Canada rather than the U.S.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
James Truslow Adams, born in 1878 to a wealthy New York family, became a financier and later an author. He won a Pulitzer Prize for a history of New England, and later he wrote a book called The Epic of America. Even though it was written during the Great Depression, Adams took a fundamentally bullish view of the United States. His book was hugely popular, and as best as we can tell, it introduced the phrase, the American dream. Adams defined this as that dream of a land in which life should be better and richer and fuller for everyone, with opportunity for each according to ability or achievement. The phrase caught on, and not just a little bit, especially among our presidents.
Now, the bedrock of our economic success is the American dream.
The American dream
does not come to those who fall asleep.
So every citizen has access to the American dream.
They have lived the American dream.
The American dream will succeed or fail in the 21st century.
The American dream is dead.
The reason my parents came to this country was in search of the American dream.
That is Raj Chetty.
So I was born in New Delhi, India, and came to the United States when I was 9 years old, and grew up mostly in the Midwest.
Chetty is now an economist at Stanford.
I study issues of inequality and opportunity and how we can use economic policy to improve people's outcomes.
Chetty was one of the scholars behind the research I cited earlier about the massive drop in the share of 30-year-old Americans earning more than their parents did. In fact, he's behind a lot of the most important research on income inequality, mobility, and the fragile state of the American dream. His work is highly regarded by the people who give awards. He's won a MacArthur Genius Fellowship and the John Bates Clark Medal. Politicians admire him as well.
Dr. Chetty, thank you for your participation.
Dr. Chetty, what do you think?
That was Senator Bernie Sanders, and before him, then-Senator Jeff Sessions, when Chetty testified at a Senate hearing on income mobility and inequality. Chetty is the policymaker's policymaker, the economist's economist, which means he tries to be, above all, empirical, not ideological or political.
One of my missions is to try to inject more evidence into these important policy debates because I think we're making huge investment decisions with very little knowledge about exactly what is going to work.
Do you vote? Are you a political participant?
I'm independent. And so, you know, that's actually, you know, I've thought hard about this. I think it's very difficult to keep yourself objective, which is very important to me. I mean, it's important to me that I have some findings that I think are more supportive of policies that Democrats are pushing, and there are some findings that are more supportive of policies that Republicans are pushing.
For all his influence, Chetty is only 37 years old.
I was actually the last person in my family to publish a paper. My parents are both in academics, and I have two older sisters who are in bioscience.
Chetty went to Harvard as an undergrad, but he didn't spend much time undergradding. He got his PhD at 23.
Basically, I did a six-year PhD and didn't go to college in the sense that starting my sophomore year, I actually didn't take any undergraduate classes.
He taught at Berkeley, then Harvard, and in 2015, he moved to Stanford. A lot of Chetty's research falls under the banner of something called the Equality of Opportunity Project. That is a group of economists and other social scientists who are trying to find the most effective and efficient ways to address chronic poverty, which, Chetty argues, is really important because the economy that for so many years facilitated the American dream for so many millions is no longer reliably doing so.
I wanted to think about whether the American dream, you know, truly is alive and well and what the determinants of the American dream are.
Okay, so how do you do that? How do you measure the state of the American dream? And more important, how do you identify the determinants that enable one family or one kid to shoot up out of poverty while others are left behind? Well, if you're an economist, you do that with data, lots and lots of data.
And so the way we came at this, the specific angle we took, is by using the large data that we have now from administrative tax and Social Security records, where we're able to see for the full population what income distributions look like for kids and for parents. And so you can basically ask, taking, say, all the kids born in America in the 1980s, what fraction of the kids born to low-income families actually make it to the top of the income distribution? And, you know, how much intergenerational mobility is there in America? In the U.S., if you take, say, the set of children who are born to families in the bottom quintile of the income distribution, in the bottom fifth, about 7.5% of those kids make it to the top fifth of the income distribution.
And that number in isolation doesn't sound off the bat so bad.
So to give some context for that, I think, Stephen, it's useful to start first by thinking about comparisons across countries. If you lived in a society where your parents played no role at all in determining your outcomes, we'd expect one-fifth of kids to rise from the bottom 20% to the top 20%. And so relative to that benchmark, that upper bound, if you will, the 13.5% rate in Canada and the 7.5% rate in the U.S., that's a really big difference. It's almost like you're twice as likely to realize the American dream of moving up if you're growing up in Canada rather than the U.S., right?
But what we want to know then is why, right? What makes that more possible in Canada? So that's what your research is really about, yes, is identifying the factors that move that needle?
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, Canada has less inequality than the U.S. There's less distance between the 20th percentile and the 80th percentile in Canada relative to America.
Which means, so are you making a social point or is this a statistical point? In other words, it's easier to move because it's a smaller jump.
That's exactly right. You know, from a statistical point of view, one view you could have is within America, there are actually a number of places that truly are lands of opportunity, places where kids achieve the American dream at high rates. In some places, like in Salt Lake City, Utah, or in the Bay Area, something like 13% of kids are making it from the bottom fifth to the top fifth. It turns out in the center of the country, like in Iowa, for example, in many areas of Iowa, you see more than 15 or 16% of kids making it from the bottom fifth to the top fifth. So higher than the numbers we see in the data for Canada and for Scandinavian countries. But at the other end of the spectrum, you take places like Atlanta, Georgia, or Charlotte, North Carolina, or much of the southeast of the U.S., and you have rates of upward mobility below 4.5%, lower than any country for which we currently have data. But I think that line of thinking would lead you to think that most of this variation is regional. But what's perhaps more surprising is that as we zoom in more finely, we continue to find almost as much variation. So kids growing up in San Francisco, for example, have about twice the chance of climbing from the bottom to top as kids just across the Bay Bridge in Oakland.
Why? One easy explanation would be that the people in those different areas are just different. They have different abilities, different cultures, different job opportunities. And that certainly has some explanatory power. But Chetty and his colleagues found the story isn't that simple.
A lot of this variation was driven by differences in childhood environment, as opposed to differences in conditions in the labor market or the types of jobs that are available or unemployment rates, things that affect you in adulthood.
This is hardly a new idea that growing up in a poor neighborhood isn't the best launching ground for economic success. This idea, in fact, led the Clinton administration to experiment in the mid-1990s with a program called Moving to Opportunity.
They took about 5,000 families across five large cities in the U.S., including New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles. So, for instance, in New York, many of the families were living in the Martin Luther King Towers, which is a very high-poverty, large public housing project in New York. So they took these families, and they randomly assigned them to one of three groups.
The first was a control group. They stayed put in the Martin Luther King Towers.
And then there were two treatment groups, one of which was called the standard Section 8 housing voucher group.
This group could use the vouchers to move wherever they wanted.
So many families, for example, moved to a place in the mid-Bronx called Soundview, which was about 6 miles away from the MLK Towers. So not in the super high concentrated poverty public housing project, but not in a dramatically different neighborhood either.
Families in the third group were also given a housing voucher.
However, with an additional restriction, which was that you could only use this voucher to rent a house or apartment in a place with a poverty rate below 10%. So basically trying to encourage families to move into more mixed income areas.
Hence the program's name, Moving to Opportunity, or MTO. The people behind the program suspected, or at least hoped, that families who removed themselves from concentrated poverty would end up having better outcomes themselves for both the adults already in the labor market and their kids who'd be coming into the labor market. So what happened?
What you ended up finding was, frankly, I think somewhat disappointing. So you didn't see any differences in employment rates or average levels of earnings.
There were some positive health effects, lower obesity and better mental health, for instance, but the MTO experiment was largely considered a failure.
I think it left the field in kind of a difficult spot because people still, you know, I think instinctively felt and anecdotally felt like, of course, it's got to matter where you grow up. But this gold standard scientific experiment is telling us that it doesn't matter for economic outcomes.
That indeed was the consensus among researchers who analyzed the MTO data. But several years later, Chetty and his colleague Nathaniel Hendren wound up taking another look at the data. And they saw a rather large benefit among some people who'd participated in MTO. Why?
Our hypothesis was that earlier studies of MTO had looked at impacts on adults and children who were older at the point of the move.
Remember, the Moving to Opportunity experiment was conducted in the mid-1990s. The studies that found disappointing results were published roughly 10 years later.
And of course, the children who were very young at the point the experiment was implemented, say kids who were 2 or 3 years old, 10 years after the experiment was implemented, they were still only 12. And so obviously you couldn't measure their earnings at that point because they weren't working yet. So these earlier studies, for that reason, mainly focused on adults and older youth, and they didn't find much of an impact. But to us, in light of our findings on the importance of childhood exposure, that actually made sense.
And that's what led Chetty and his colleagues to re-examine the MTO data. They added a layer of IRS data in order to measure the longer-term earnings for the kids who were young when they moved.
And when you look at children who moved when they were young, you see extremely clearly that they are doing dramatically better today as adults. They are earning 30% more. They're 27% more likely to go to college. They're 30% less likely to become single parents. And that, in our view, just kind of completely changed everything and I think has changed people's perceptions of MTO.
Okay, so young kids who move out of a high poverty neighborhood do much better later on. What exactly does this signify? What's going on in the poor neighborhoods to depress income mobility, and what's going on in the better neighborhoods to increase it? Answering those questions has become a big part of Raj Chetty's work. He and his colleagues have come up with 5 significant explanations.
The first is residential segregation. Cities that are more segregated by income and by race tend to have very low rates of upward mobility.
The second factor?
Income inequality. You have more people in the middle class, you also tend to have higher levels of upward mobility. This relationship is what Alan Krueger, based on cross-country data, termed the Great Gatsby curve, the idea that there's a link between inequality in any one generation and rates of intergenerational mobility. Why is this link interesting if one can interpret it causally? It suggests that as we have growing inequality over time, as we do in the U.S., we might be concerned about that not just because we're worried about equitable distribution, but also because we're worried that it might erode children's chances of achieving the American dream.
The third factor they identified relates to family.
We find that places with more single parents have significantly lower levels of upward mobility. Now, in interpreting this correlation, it's very important to note that it's not purely driven by the fact that growing up in a one-parent family leads to worse outcomes for children. And the way you can see that is if we look at the subset of kids who grow up in a two-parent household, we see that for that subset of children, even for them, growing up in a neighborhood with a lot of single parents is associated with lower levels of upward mobility. So it's not literally about whether your own parents are married or not. Again, it's picking up some community-level factor.
The fourth factor?
Social capital. And so the idea of social capital, I think of it in relation to the old adage that it takes a village to raise a child. Will someone else in your community help you out when you need help? So as an example, Salt Lake City with the Mormon Church is thought to be the quintessential example of a city with a lot of social capital, and correspondingly in our data seems to exhibit a lot of social mobility. The fifth factor is school quality. We find that places with better public schools, as you might expect intuitively, have much higher rates of upward mobility. And on that dimension, there's a lot of very good evidence showing that improving the quality of schools can really meaningfully affect rates of intergenerational mobility. So I would treat school quality a little bit differently from the other 4 factors where we see strong correlations but are not yet sure exactly what the causal mechanisms are.
Now, each of the factors that you've discussed Even I could think of some potential policy ideas to improve them. Do you think much about that, or are you content at this point to do the research that allows policymakers to have those ideas and make those moves?
Absolutely, we want to take the next step. And so, you know, that I think is a good segue now to come back to the Moving to Opportunity experiment, which I see as a way to potentially tackle segregation. One concrete way in which you might try to integrate a city is by giving families, low-income families, housing assistance to be able to rent houses in more mixed-income neighborhoods.
Now, I could hear you talking about this, extolling the virtues, the latent virtues that you ultimately unearthed of a program like Moving to Opportunity, where the government spends a bunch of money to relocate families. And I could think, oh, you're just another big government spending advocate. So I'm curious, as an economist, how you would assess the efficiency of typical or historical housing spending in the U.S. and compare that to the ROI on something like Moving to Opportunity.
I certainly recognize that in a time when we have a government that's already spending quite a bit on initiatives like this, the answer can't simply be to just spend more on these problems. I think we're not spending that money in the most efficient possible way in order to achieve outcomes like reduced poverty in the long run. So let me give you a couple of examples on dimensions in which we can, I think, make improvements. First, the optimal age at which to help families move is when their kids are born or when their kids are very young. In practice, we do almost exactly the opposite. We put families on waiting lists when they have kids, and those waiting lists sometimes take many, many years, particularly in the most depressed cities where we really would like to be moving families out of concentrated poverty. And so what ends up happening is that families only get the opportunity to move exactly when their kids are older, which is exactly backwards, right, in terms of what you'd like to be accomplishing here. So that's a tweak that would not increase program costs, but I think would dramatically increase impact. The government will actually recover much of the money we invest in programs like this, because we see that these children who are earning 30% more as adults, they, of course, are paying more in income taxes themselves as they have higher earnings. And so we calculate that the extra income taxes that they pay actually more than offsets the incremental cost of a program like Moving to Opportunity. So it's actually, a budget-saving program in many ways.
Since our interview with Raj Chetty, he has met for an hour and a half with Ben Carson, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. As Chetty described it in an email, he and his staff were eager to hear about how the data could help us make better use of the dollars HUD is spending to achieve better outcomes for low-income children. We asked Chetty if he would consider serving in this administration himself. I would not have considered serving in either a Trump or Clinton administration, he wrote, largely because I'd like to continue focusing on research to identify the best policy solutions at this point. Perhaps down the road, I'd reconsider. Chetty also wrote this: I hope that the new administration will take an evidence-based approach to making policy decisions, for instance, by making smart investments in childhood education, affordable housing, and other programs that can create opportunity in effective ways. Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, we will expand this conversation about the state of the American dream. One argument we've all heard is that the U.S. was too willing to let its manufacturing jobs go to China and elsewhere. Economists were, for the most part, sanguine. They told us not to worry, that the upsides of global trade would cancel out the downsides of that job loss. What do they say now?
I'm much less sanguine about it than I used to be. I think if we had realized how traumatic the pace of change would have been, we would have, at a minimum, had much better policies in place to assist workers and communities that suffered these very severe and immediate consequences, and we might have tried to moderate the pace at which it occurred.
The true story of Chinese trade and American job loss, that's next on Freakonomics Radio.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio with your host, Stephen Dubner.
I entered the profession late, actually. I had several failed careers prior to economics.
That's David Autor, A-U-T-O-R, if you want to look him up.
I'm a labor economist at MIT.
And what does a labor economist do?
I work a lot on skill demands and changes in labor markets having to do with technology and with trade as well.
As Otter said, he came late to academia.
I did software development for a while. And I also spent several years directing a nonprofit in San Francisco that did computer education for the poor. And then I also did a lot of work in fast food. I spent a month working at McDonald's and half a year working at Papagino's, which is a kind of pizza franchise in the Boston area. So I did a lot of blue collar work. I also worked as a temp. I did, you know, light construction and cleaning. I also fix cars and motorcycles and electronics.
So Otter hasn't spent his entire adulthood in the ivory tower, and that is reflected in his choice of economic specialty.
I think we labor economists like to think of ourselves as being closer to the people. I'm pretty cognizant of how tough the labor market has been for them for the last 35 years.
For the past several years, Otter and several colleagues, including Gordon Hansen, David Dorn, Darren Acemoglu, Brendan Price, and Kaveh Majlisi, have been analyzing huge data sets to try to answer an important economic question.
The objective was to understand how China's very rapidly rising exports to the United States were affecting U.S. labor markets.
Today on Freakonomics Radio, the answer to that question, how it relates to American political rhetoric, and what economists got wrong.
I think if we had realized how traumatic the pace of change would have been, we would have, at a minimum, had much better policies in place.
During the 2016 presidential campaign, many people were so focused on Donald Trump's outrageous persona that perhaps they saw his claims about China and trade as similarly outrageous, hyperbolic at best, outright wrong at worst.
We can't continue to allow China to rape our country, and that's what they're doing. It's the greatest theft in the history of the world.
But wasn't the U.S. a willing partner and an architect of the huge push toward globalization? We endorsed sending low-wage manufacturing jobs overseas, believing we'd get cheaper imports and newer, better jobs to replace the offshored ones. So how well has that dreamy scenario worked out?
I'm much less sanguine about it than I used to be.
Let's start with a bit of history between the U.S. and China. The adversarial relationship kicked off by the Communist Revolution in 1949 blossomed into a full-blown Cold War, which began to fizzle out, quite shockingly, in 1971. That's when President Richard Nixon, a devout anti-communist at that point, reached out to Chairman Mao as a partner.
The meeting between the leaders of China and the United States is to seek the normalization of relations between the two countries.
China was sort of in a perpetual state of economic crisis from the Mao Zedong era forward, and really didn't have its act together as a trading country or producer, and it was largely closed.
David Otter again.
And it wasn't until Deng Xiaoping took power and began changing things in the late 1970s and began what he called reform and opening, which meant setting up export zones in the southern parts of China across from Hong Kong, allowing foreign direct investment, allowing use of market prices, allowing for mobility of labor. So over the course of 20 years, about a quarter of a billion people migrated out of a relatively unproductive rural agriculture into cities to do production. Just incredible.
Between 1991 and 2013, Chinese exports grew from roughly 2% of the world's total to nearly 20%.
And China marched from being, you know, 30 or 40 years behind the frontier of production to being really a world-class producer with, at that time, lots of available labor and lots of available land and, you know, lots of resources.
Other countries had taken the same route as China, but China was different in several ways, but most significantly in size.
So, you know, if a country like Vietnam or Cambodia or something went through the exact same developmental process as China, it would quickly run out of capacity. And after a very little while, it would have made all the, you know, the iPhones and the apparel and the toys and so on it could. And then wages would rise, prices would rise. And it would just be a blip on the world scale. But because China is so enormous and had so much slack, it took decades for that string to play out. And in that time, it was just producing goods, high-quality goods at low prices,
that were extraordinarily competitive by world standards. And this had the effect of displacing a lot of competitor countries' production, including the United States.
So, David, you and some colleagues have taken a hard look at how globalization has had some profound effects. So tell us broadly what you know and how you know it.
Sure. So economists have known forever, or, you know, since the 1950s, that globalization, or the integration between trading partners, raises GDP, raises national incomes in both countries if they're consenting partners, but can have adverse distributional consequences.
Adverse distributional consequences being economist speak for a rising tide that does not lift all boats.
So even as it makes a country wealthier, it can make some people in that country poorer in absolute terms. So it can grow the size of the pie, but make some slices sufficiently smaller that in net they contract. However, literature had failed to find any strong evidence that those adverse distributional consequences were coming to pass.
The literature being the economics literature, meaning that as economists watched globalization accelerate, it seemed to be working out pretty well.
I think labor economics sort of 15 years ago, a lot of people saw it as, oh, well, now we're sort of studying well-functioning markets. It's about characterizing equilibria and explaining why it's all efficient. We should turn our attention to the developing world where all the problems are.
That view turned out to be illusory, or at least short-lived.
But now we have lots of problems. People recognize that, and they sort of see labor as being part of the big challenges facing lots of countries, including the developed world, in terms of income distribution, opportunity, the sort of a changing share of national income going to capital versus labor, the role of globalization in shaping opportunities, and even the way that labor markets feed into political outcomes and people's sense of party identity and the type of candidates that they vote for.
That said, David Auder is not willing to throw his profession under the bus.
I don't think the old evidence was incorrect. There are two big differences of the last two decades relative to earlier periods. One is that a lot of our trade prior to China's rise, a lot of it was north-north trade, you know, trading between wealthy nations. So, you know, we sell aircraft engines to France and we buy, you know, we cheese and wine and Renaults, or maybe we buy Mercedes from Germany. So it's a lot of high-skilled people trading high-skilled goods, and we're trading on the basis of taste. Like, I like your vehicles, you like my aircraft. It's not trying to see who can make the cheapest version of X, Y, or Z. We're often focusing on a set of expensive goods in which we all are differently good at different subsets.
But when China opened up, that changed.
A lot of what we're trading there is labor-intensive goods. Nothing that China was selling the United States, especially up until recently, couldn't be made in the U.S. It just couldn't be made as cheaply. So this was actually about price competition rather than simply having a better or different variety.
On the surface, that might seem fine. Again, it would mean Americans and many others getting to buy cheaper goods because they're made in China. But of course, the calculus is trickier than that.
So when the United States trades with the developing world, we're going to typically export skill-intensive products, you know, aircraft engines, electronics, movies and TV programs, and things that use a lot of highly educated labor. And we're going to tend to import low-skill or what we would call labor-intensive products like, you know, footwear and textiles, leather goods, things that require a lot of hand assembly. And so what does that do? Well, when we export those high skill-intensive goods, we're basically raising demand for skilled or educated workers in the United States. When we import those labor-intensive goods, we're going to reduce demand for blue-collar workers who are not doing skill-intensive production. Now, we benefit because we get lower prices on the goods we consume, and we sell the things that we're good at making at a higher price to the world. So that raises GDP, but simultaneously, it tends to make high-skilled and highly educated labor better off, raise their wages, and it tends to make low-skill, manual-intensive laborers worse off because there's less demand for their services. So there's going to be fewer of them employed, or they're going to be employed at lower wages. So the net effect, you can show analytically, is going to be positive. But the redistributional consequences are, many of us would view that as adverse, because we'd rather redistribute from rich to poor than poor to rich. And trade is kind of working in the redistributing from poor to rich direction in the United States. the scale of the benefits and harms are rather incommensurate. So, you know, for individuals, you know, I have less expensive consumer items because of imports from China, but it hasn't affected my employment or my wages. For many others, on the order of at least a million U.S. manufacturing workers, it meant the end of their jobs and, in many cases, the end of their industries.
But that wasn't even the worst of it. Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, the true breadth of the problem, and we talk about solutions.
I don't think there are any easy solutions. I don't think if I were, you know, Labor Secretary, I would just be able to get in and, you know, turn this ship around.
That's coming up right after the break.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
David Auder, a labor economist at MIT, has spent the past few years working with fellow economists to measure the effects of global trade, especially between the U.S. and China. A lot of political rhetoric argues that China has damaged the U.S. economy via currency manipulation, making Chinese goods even more attractive to American consumers.
It's the single greatest tool they have, currency manipulation, and they're grandmasters. They do a great job. I congratulate them. I'm not angry at China. I'm angry at our country for allowing them to do it. Okay, I'm not angry at China.
Auder's research reveals a story that is in some ways more complicated than Donald Trump's explanation, and in some ways simpler.
What occurred is not primarily the result of currency manipulation or cheating or unfair trade deals. It was a function of China's extremely rapid development, which, by the way, is a very good thing, you know, brought 400 million Chinese out of poverty, raised incomes in Central and South America, caused investment throughout Africa, right? This is sort of the best thing to happen to the global middle class in at least a millennium, right? But it was tough on U.S. manufacturing.
Very tough. Especially after 2001, when China was accepted into the World Trade Organization.
China's entrance into the World Trade Organization has enabled the greatest job theft in the history of our country.
We would conservatively estimate that more than a million manufacturing jobs in the U.S. were directly eliminated between 2000 and 2007 as a result of China's accelerating trade penetration in the United States. Now, that doesn't mean a million jobs total. Maybe some of those workers moved into other sectors. But we've looked at that, and as best we can find, in that period, you do not see that kind of reallocation. So we estimate that as much as 40% of the drop in U.S. manufacturing between 2000 and 2007 is attributable to the trade shock that occurred in that period, which is really following China's accession to the WTO in 2001.
Are you controlling for the effects of technology here?
Yes, to the best we can, to the best we can. We do have measures of sort of exposure to automation and so on. And as far as we can tell, that's not really the main driver. Now, I think it's reasonable to argue, well, you know, given 15 or 20 more years, it would have been.
Right.
So the question then is, well, what happens? Where do those workers go? So some people are leaving the labor market. Some people are going into unemployment. Some people are going on to disability. And so the reallocation process seems to be slow, frictional, and scarring.
Okay, so until scarring, those words sounded fairly clinical and academic, but what you're describing here is really bad, A, correct?
Yeah.
And B, I'm just curious, before we move on, you looked at a whole lot of different manufacturing ecosystems. I'm sure there's great variance, or I'm assuming there's great variance from one to the next. Can you talk about some ecosystems, some manufacturing industries or jobs where people did do a better job adapting?
You know, actually, the real differentiator is the kind of skill level of the worker. So higher paid and more highly educated workers, they seem to reallocate successfully out of manufacturing into other jobs. So the shocks to manufacturing affect everyone in the immediately targeted industry. But the differentiator is not what industry you were in specifically, but how skilled you were initially.
So the HR person at a big textile firm gets an HR job elsewhere, and the manufacturers on the line are probably not.
And the line workers are much less likely to do so, exactly.
Right. Okay.
And, you know, look, there are 3,000 counties in the United States. If 10,000 workers were eliminated, you know, three from each county, you wouldn't even notice it, right? But if 10,000 workers are eliminated simultaneously from your, you know, local labor market, that's very noticeable. And it has kind of add-on effects because, gee, well, then you, those manufacturers also stop, you know, buying the delivery services and the catering services. People have less income, so they go out to dinner less. So all kinds of kind of adverse multipliers, not huge, but noticeable, measurable, set in.
Maybe this is not a multiplier. Maybe I'm defining it wrong. But what about with all those relatively low-skilled workers out there floating around looking for jobs? Presumably, that could lower the wage of other existing jobs or no?
Yes. Yeah, that's what we find, actually, that you see a kind of decline in the wage level, not just in manufacturing. You also see people going on using public transfer benefits like unemployment and trade adjustment, but actually much more numerically, quantitatively large are disability, Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps, TANF, early retirement. So those programs actually are numerically, you know, fiscally much, much larger.
Look at all those downstream effects from China's manufacturing growth that David Auder identifies in the U.S. Job loss, wage depression, higher welfare spending. In another research paper, he and his colleagues found yet another downside. Many economists had suspected that greater competition with China would create incentives for American companies to invest more in research and development and become more innovative. But it hasn't worked out that way. Instead, Auder and his colleagues found, Chinese competition has lowered profit margins for American manufacturers, leaving less money for R&D and resulting in less innovation. People like you, meaning economists, not like you, David Auder, necessarily, you know, have been telling us for several decades now that globalization would be largely win-win. I'm not so naive as to think that there are no losers. I get that. But that overall, we Americans should kind of sit back and relax, that it would be good for the median U.S. resident. So I don't feel that way anymore. And tell me if I'm wrong to not feel that way. And additionally, if I'm wrong, maybe to blame you and your cohort a little bit.
I think if we had realized how traumatic the pace of change would have been, we would have, at a minimum, had much better policies in place to assist workers and communities that suffered these very severe and immediate consequences. And we might have tried to moderate the pace at which it occurred. And let me add another factor that really augments this is we also had a huge trade deficit. And that meant that we simply did a lot less manufacturing. So that meant that workers had to make a tougher transition out of manufacturing into something altogether new. And I think that upped the challenge. It made it harder for people to reallocate. If it was one thing if they were going, you know, they're getting out of textiles and moving into automobiles or tools. But that's not what happened. They're getting out of textiles and moving into Walmart. You know, moving into fast food. I think the other thing that we have to recognize and that economists have tended not to emphasize is that jobs aren't purely income. They are part of identity. They structure people's lives. They give them a purpose and a social community and a sense of relevance in the world. And I think that is a lot of the frustration that we see in manufacturing-intensive areas. We saw a lot of that actually in the recent election. People feel like their place in the universe, or at least in the economy, has really been kind of reduced, made less valuable. And I think that that's costly even beyond the direct financial costs.
So President Trump did not choose you, David Auder, as labor secretary. So if it had been you, and maybe someday it will be, what to do about it? Tell us some things that are potential remedies or at least better thinking frameworks to approach the future of labor in this country.
So it's a challenging question. I don't think there are any easy solutions. I do think there are tax changes that we ought to make that could be beneficial. One of them that's actually being talked about in the Trump administration is the so-called border adjustment, which is a way, complicated story, but it's like a value-added tax. And if it were used to offset other taxes, like our payroll tax, for example. Right now, our payroll tax raises the cost of producing in the United States, but foreign countries, when they import here, they don't pay our payroll tax. If we had a value-added tax, that would be levied both on things produced domestically and on things that are imported. If it were used to offset the payroll tax, why, that would have the effect of basically making imports a little bit more expensive relative to domestically produced goods. I don't think that's a terrible idea. Many countries do something that looks a bit like that. I think the other things are, importantly, are skills investments. And then I think also things that make the quality of life better for people with low incomes, including, I'm afraid to say it, the Affordable Care Act, which is a very good policy that we will be saying goodbye to soon.
So those all sound interesting and perhaps viable and perhaps useful, but most of them are coming primarily from one direction, which is basically they're costly ways to support the people who have lost out because of this economic change. What about reversing that dynamic? So obviously this president, that's his gospel on the labor front to date, which is reshoring, or I don't know what you call it in the case of Carrier, where you don't let him get away in the first place. What's your view on that?
Well, so the border adjustment that I talked about actually would have the effect of encouraging domestic production. You know, a number of things. First of all, many of those labor-intensive jobs are not going to come back. Even if the production returned to the United States, it would be done with a lot more machinery and robotics. I think manufacturing will continue to occur in the United States. I just don't think it's going to use that much labor. I think it's perfectly reasonable to aggressively enforce our trade deals. There are certainly countries that dump products, that steal intellectual property, that create anti-competitive barriers in their own country so the U.S. can't export to them, even though it's importing from them. But I don't think we can turn back the clock. And moreover, remember that many of those imports, for one, they do make consumer prices lower. And two, they're often inputs into things that we're making and then exporting or consuming domestically, right? So as soon as you start taxing Chinese goods, you're taxing car parts that end up in GM and Ford and Fiat Chrysler automobiles. So you'll quickly find that there's a lot of opposition from U.S. manufacturers to restrictions on trade or tariffs. You might think, oh, no, we're doing you a favor. We're, you know, making your products more competitive. Well, not if you're importing a lot of your components.
President Trump has been accused of ignoring evidence on a lot of fronts. In this case, when it comes to the costs of globalization, it strikes me that his views are kind of align quite closely with the views of economists like you who do see evidence that supports some of the, at least his proclamations about the costs of globalization. Where do you find yourself on that spectrum, whether politically per se or just philosophically?
Well, I want to be clear. President Trump makes a lot of unfounded claims about trade that I do not agree with. For example, that NAFTA was a disaster for the United States. Very, very little evidence to suggest that was true. It was actually mostly a win for the United States, but pretty modest. I also, you know, strongly disagree with the idea that we ought to be slapping extremely high tariffs on importers. I think that would be quite damaging to the U.S. Similarly, I don't favor strong-arming companies to keep employment here if it's going to deter others from creating jobs here out of fear that they'll then be forced to retain them. So I don't even think trade has been a net bad for the United States. I just think it's created real concentrated adverse impacts, which I, you know, Trump was right to recognize. And that's where I'm more in sympathy with the administration than on other points. I'll finally say that a good example of where bad thinking and bad trade policy has come in immediately is in this whole debate around the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was basically a forward-looking trade agreement that was set up as a bulwark against Chinese domination of Asia. You know, Trump said on the campaign trail, China will take advantage of us through the TPP like they always do.
The TPP is a horrible deal. It is a deal that is going to lead to nothing but trouble. It's a deal that was designed for China to come in, as they always do, through the back door and totally take advantage of everyone.
I don't think he even realized at the point that China was not a signatory to the TPP, and China was the country cheering loudest to see it crash and burn, because it was basically establishing rules of the game with Asia and North America, the United States, that would uphold intellectual property agreements, freedom and transparency of contracting, market access, and so on. So if we don't set the rules of the game in Asia, China will, and I don't think we'll like those rules nearly as much. So that's just this kind of bluster against trade that is ignorant and harmful to the U.S. interests and really harmful to our allies, including most especially Japan.
So David, I know you've said that economics wasn't entirely wrong on this prediction, that global trade would kind of work out okay. But I do think a lot of people would disagree. Obviously, it's a matter of degrees. So if that's my view, and I think that, you know, many or most economists were wrong on something as basic and important as this, why should we ever listen to what you wonderfully educated egghead economists have to say when it comes to something as important and broad as macroeconomic issues that will affect my actual life? You can predict all you want about currency stories abroad, etc. But if it's my life, my livelihood, my job, my family, my ability to provide for them, you guys are supposed to be the nonpartisan, smart, apolitical cohort out there, and I trusted you, and now I'm sorry I did, because if I hadn't, I might have changed course 15 or 20 years ago, and while I might not be in great shape, I'd certainly be in better shape than I am now.
Well, I don't know that you'd be in better shape. You'd be in different shape, and a different group of people would be benefiting. I don't think we'd be wealthier, but I think it's a really good question. The evidence that economists were relying on, you know, up through the 2000s, wasn't incorrect for its time. It just turned out not to be fully predictive of what happened next. And that's, you know, that's sort of cold comfort, I realize. Contemporary economics is quite imperfect, but I think it's at least guided by evidence, mm-hmm. and economists are fully capable of changing their views based on evidence. I do not think the profession actually is nearly as ideological as it was 25 years ago when it was guided so much by theory. Now it's really guided by data. And, you know, case in point, the work that we've done, you know, it's been somewhat controversial, but by and large, economists have really embraced and said, oh yeah, wow, you know, we're surprised and this changes how we think about it. And again, I don't want to claim that we were, you know, some upstarts. We just happened to look at the right data and come away with conclusions that none of us were expecting. But I think that's, you know, that's about as good as social science does. We're not working with natural laws that are can be as neatly summarized as Newtonian physics.
I have no idea if you'll agree, but David Autor strikes me as a particularly keen and fair-minded analyst and observer of the U.S. labor markets. It doesn't seem as if he's got a horse in the race, doesn't seem as if he's got his thumb on the scale. And his insights seem useful, at least as useful as a diagnosis can be once you're already sick. There's just one caveat I'd add to his message. It has to do with the predictions that economists made about how Chinese manufacturing would affect the American labor market.
The evidence that economists were relying on up through the 2000s wasn't incorrect for its time. It just turned out not to be fully predictive of what happened next.
This program has gone on and on about the folly of prediction. In fact, there's a Freakonomics Radio episode from years ago called The Folly of Prediction. We talked about how one of the most common explanations of smart people when their predictions turn out to be inaccurate was that, well, we did the best we could considering the information we had at the time. If we'd had better information, we could have made a better prediction. But you know what? If you had better information at the time, you wouldn't have to make a prediction. The future would have been obvious. But that's the thing about the future. It's rarely obvious, which leaves a lot of room for all kinds of people to make all kinds of predictions that may or may not come true. I'm not calling out David Autor here. Again, I really appreciate his transparency and his doggedness. But the story of Chinese manufacturing and American labor is yet another reminder of how humble we should all be when we make a prediction and how cautious we should all be when we hear one. Beware the punditry, no matter how well-degreed they are, or well-spoken, or well-coiffed. Don't assume they can know the future any better than you do. And don't assume you're such a genius either. I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. If you just can't wait that long, you can find our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at Freakonomics.com or on iTunes, where you can also subscribe.